Mark Howard is a professor of government and law at Georgetown University, where he also directs the Prisons and Justice Initiative. In a recent New York Times op-ed piece headed The Practical Case for Violent Offenders, he argued that the American justice system has become unusually cruel and that our criminal justice system, quote, combines exceptionally coercive plea bargaining, exceptionally long sentences, exceptionally brutal prison conditions, and exceptionally difficult obstacles to societal reentry. Although, he points out, it hasn't always been that way. I'm pleased to welcome Mark Howard to our show. Hi.
Hi, Leonard. Good to be with you.
Your book, Unusually Cruel, Prisons, Punishment, and the Real American Exceptionalism, was inspired by your own experience of winding up in a jail cell in London in 1985. What were you put in jail for?
Well, it's a story I haven't told until recently, and I think my parents would probably prefer I never tell it. But when I was 13-year-old, rising into ninth grade the following year, my traveling soccer team was on a trip to England, playing against different English soccer teams. And as it turns out, another player and I decided to shoplift. And so we went into an HMV store and started stealing cassettes. So I'm dating myself right here by saying these were cassettes, not even CDs, much less MP3s. And we got caught, and they didn't take us very kindly, and we wound up going into a jail cell for much of the afternoon.
Although
harrowing experience.
Well, it obviously left quite an impression on you, but did it leave any real scars?
Well, I had a juvenile record in England, I was told, until age 17 when it would be destroyed. And I was also told I would be banned from HMV stores, and it wasn't clear to me if that was what time period. So I've never been back, just to be safe. But no, I think that the fact that it happened in the UK and not in the US probably made it easier for me to escape unscathed, so to speak. But more importantly, I've kind of been through the experience myself of rebuilding, of going through a stupid phase, of making mistakes, of being on a bad path. But I think I've been able to turn that around and make the most of my own second chance. And I think the fact that that happened in the UK, well, maybe not completely decisive. I might have been able to do that if it had happened to me in New York or somewhere else in the States. But I think it did make it more likely that I would not get trapped into a cycle of juvenile delinquency leading a pathway towards prison longer term.
You say small crimes here sometimes lead to a life of incarceration.
They often do. I mean, you know, I spend a lot of time actually in prison. I volunteer as a professor in a maximum security prison in Maryland, which I've been doing every week for the past 3 years. And, you know, so many of the stories that I've heard from my students started out with stupid juvenile delinquency, stealing and leading to often selling drugs or doing drugs, and then bigger stuff that, of course, winds up with a much longer sentence. So I do think that for many people, it starts quite young, and I think how we treat youth in this country is not really fulfilling them on the right path. We lock people up very, very quickly and for long periods of time and don't take into account enough the fact that they're often kids who are really not well-informed and making poor choices, acting under peer pressure, trying to impress their friends, and not really, you know, understanding the consequences of what they're doing. There's been a lot of brain research on the development of kids showing that they really lack impulse control, and unfortunately, a few bad choices can be a lifetime of consequences in the United States.
Wasn't there another incident that led you to think about these matters that occurred during your senior year of high school when a friend was arrested for the murder of his parents?
Yeah, it's a horrible story, although it does have a happy ending now. But my childhood friend is named Marty Tankliff, and I'm sure many of your listeners will have heard of that name. It's a very highly publicized case in New York. It took place on Long Island, where I grew up, and with Marty. And Marty is a good friend of mine. We've known each other since we were 3 years old, actually went to preschool and elementary school and junior high school and high school together. And the first day of our senior year of high school, Marty's parents were brutally murdered. And by the end of the day, he was in handcuffs. And a year or so later, he was convicted of their murder and sentenced to 50 years to life in a maximum security prison in upstate New York.
How old was he?
And I believed in his... He was 17. He had just turned 17. We both were 9 days apart, actually. He just turned 17 when the crime took place, and he was 18 when he went to prison. And he was sentenced to 50 years, so he would have been first eligible for parole at the age of 68.
You went off to jail after high school, and he went to jail. When did you reconnect?
I went to Yale. He went to jail. Yeah, that's our line. but we reconnected. I always believed in his innocence, and I wrote about it in our high school newspaper, and was a firm believer that there was a lot more evidence pointing to his father's business partner, who it turns out had hired hitmen who committed the crime and killed Marty's parents, and possibly even paid off a police detective to implicate Marty. But in a court of law, conviction is very strong, and when he was sentenced, it really looked like there was very little chance. And as it turns out, I started to get involved in the second decade of his incarceration, and we became very close, and I started to visit him regularly in prison and really became committed and made him a promise that I would never stop fighting for his release and also to be his friend and support him in any way I could in his life after his release. And as it turns out, he was exonerated and came out of prison December 27, 2007.
Well, that's 17 years after. But he was in jail for 17 years for a crime he didn't commit.
Yeah, that's right. It's a horrible story, but for me, it really changed my life. And it led me to not only make a personal commitment to him, but also I decided to go to law school, actually. And I was a tenured professor. I'd written several books. I was very established in my field, which was quite different, comparative politics. I was a specialist on Europe. Yet this sort of gnawing thorn in my side kept growing and growing, and I decided I need to do something about it. So I initially decided to go to law school at Georgetown, where I'm a professor, so it was very easy, convenient, and also free, by the way. And I, just before I started, actually, Marty was exonerated. But by then, I was so committed to his cause and to the larger cause of criminal justice reform that I kept going. So I got my JD. I'm now a member of the New York Bar. I don't actively practice law, though I haven't ruled it out. I still pay my dues. But it's really the experience that Marty went through opened my eyes to the horror show that is American criminal justice. In his case, of course, it was particularly egregious because it was a wrongful conviction. And there's nothing worse than you know, his circumstances, not only losing his parents, but being convicted of it wrongfully, and then spending 6,338 days in prison as an innocent man. But what I learned is there's so much about how our meat grinder system of justice treats people, whether they're innocent or guilty, which is so incredibly unjust. And so what I did is I brought together my sort of training as a comparative political scientist to this question of criminal justice, and that's what led to the book Unusually Cruel, where I compare the U.S. to a set of European countries, France, Germany, and the U.K., on a whole series of different elements of the what I call the life cycle of criminal justice. Parole, which is what the op-ed was about that you referred to earlier, is one piece of that, but there are other pieces as well, but I'm happy to talk about any of them.
With just 5% of the world's population in this country, we have 25% of the world's prisoners. And we are, our record of arrests, prosecutions, and the jailing of people, juveniles and adults, is higher than any other country in the world or any other country in the industrial world.
Actually higher than any other country in the world, so
including
than China, Russia, Saudi Arabia, you name it. But it's about 7 to 10 times higher than any advanced industrialized democracy. So the type of countries that we would consider similar countries were so far off the charts that it's just another galaxy.
Do we know why we've chosen this approach so different from other advanced democracies?
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of elements to it. I think that race plays a central role, and we're certainly seeing a lot about that these days. There's a long history of racial discrimination and racial subjugation in this country.
But Marty Tankleff wasn't black.
No, Marty Tankleff wasn't black, and I actually make that point to show just how hard it was for somebody who had all the advantages, being white, upper middle class, major media market, having a lot of attention paid to his case, having over a dozen pro bono attorneys from top firms who are extraordinary. And even with Marty's circumstances, it took 19 different appeals. It took 17 and a half years to get out. And for the people who don't have any of those advantages, they have no chance, right? And there are countless people in those circumstances, right? But in terms of what explains the American exceptionalism, as I call it here, the real American exceptionalism, I think that race certainly plays a role. Religion plays a role. We have a highly punitive eye for an eye version, particularly in the evangelical faith, that is very unforgiving. And I think, ironically, actually, because there should be a strong element of redemption and understanding humanity and hoping for second chances, but that has sort of been on the margins of the evangelical movement, which has been very punitive. And then there's also a major political role. We, in our country, we elect prosecutors. We elect judges. You tell that to somebody in Europe, and their jaws drop. They don't understand how that's even possible. To become a prosecutor or a judge in Europe, you have to be the top of your class in law school, and then you get selected for the, you know, judge school, let's say. And then you have to be at the top of your class. You have to take exams that last 4 days and get the best scores on your exams. In our country, you know, you have to get some money, you fundraise, you run a campaign, and then you say you're tough on crime, and you get elected. I mean, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but to make the point, but it's really a completely different circumstance. And the final element is business. There's a tremendous for-profit motive in our criminal justice system, where people are making money at every stage of incarceration.
Wasn't there fear of an increase in crime at one point that led to new laws? And there was a whole matter
Absolutely.
Of the war on drugs, although the war on drugs now has been replaced by concern about opioid abuse being a medical condition rather than a criminal condition.
Right. So certainly in terms of the rise in crime in the 1970s, that played a huge role. And it's absolutely true that there was an increase in violent crime and that there was a tremendous fear of violent crime that led to a lot of political reactions to create very, very tough laws in terms of sentencing that boosted mass incarceration. Crime has been going down every year since the 1990s. Yet, now you wouldn't necessarily know it hearing some of the political rhetoric, but those are the clear, indisputable facts. But the war on drugs is something that, you know, this isn't a partisan issue, by the way, in terms of Democrat, Republican. Both sides were gung-ho, and everyone from Bill Clinton to Joe Biden on the Democratic side and Newt Gingrich and many others on the Republican side in the 1990s were just trying to outdo each other to be tougher and tougher on crime. And the war on drugs is something that today virtually everybody, any objective analyst who looks at it, says it was a complete failure. Yet we have now a new administration, of course, and a new Justice Department that is calling for a reinvigoration of the war on drugs. Yet at the same time, there's a focus on opioid addiction and so on. So we're living actually in very uncertain times right now, this current phase that we're in terms of what direction it will lead to in terms of criminal justice reform. But the war on drugs is by no means over, and it might be ramping up again.
We have to take a little break. We'll come back with more from Mark Marjay Howard, professor of government and law at Georgetown University, where he directs the Prisons and Justice Initiative. His latest book, his third from Oxford University Press, is called Unusually Cruel: Prisons, Punishment, and the Real American Exceptionalism. Stay with us for more. And we are back with Mark Howard, professor of government and law and director of the Prisons and Justice Initiative at Georgetown University. His latest book is Unusually Cruel: Prisons, Punishment, and the Real American Exceptionalism. It's published by Oxford University Press. You have a particularly chilling chart in the introduction to your book in which you show the lifetime likelihood of imprisonment of U.S. residents born in 2001. One in nine of all men, one in 17 of all white men, one in three for black men, and one in six for Latino men?
Yeah, it's very haunting. That comes from the Sentencing Project that I've reproduced based on Bureau of Justice Statistics data. It really is a statistic I think should give us all pause. We're doing something wrong in our country if the odds of a black boy born in 2001 is over 30% of winding up in prison. And if you add some other qualifiers, such as not having an African-American boy who does not graduate from high school, the odds are over two-thirds of winding up in prison.
95% of all...
It's almost a prison sentence.
95% of all criminal proceedings are actually settled through plea bargaining. What percentage of plea bargains end with a prison sentence?
Oh, the vast majority do. I mean, sometimes there might be a plea bargain that leads to probation only with no jail time. But in most cases, it's a bargain that sort of brings perhaps down the charge and a quote-unquote compromise on the sentence. But the main point on plea bargaining is that it's, well, to some people it might sound like it's a lenient compromise where the prosecutors give someone a break and let them go unless. It's actually a process that's completely controlled by the cards that the prosecutors hold and run the show. The court systems would grind to a halt if everyone insisted on a jury trial. Even though there's a constitutional right to a trial by jury, the system pushes people towards a plea bargain. And in many cases, people take a plea simply because they need to get out of jail, because a lot of times they're stuck in jail awaiting trial, and then the plea gets offered, and it's their only ticket to get out or to have a path towards getting out. But it's a very, very flawed process. And again, when you scratch the surface of it and when you compare it to other countries, as I do in the book, you realize that there are very few protections for defendants. And it's a very, very lopsided process that I think is grotesquely unfair and unconscionable in the light of the protections that we're supposed to be guaranteeing and the right to trial that people are supposed to have. But we bring so many people up on charges in this country that if everyone were to go to trial, it would take 10 years, 15 years to get to a trial. So we have this process of plea bargaining that's sort of a release valve, but one that's really very, very imbalanced and flawed.
Don't many people choose plea bargains simply because they fear what might happen if they go to trial, that they might wind up with a much worse kind of penalty?
That's right. So it's what's called the trial penalty. In other words, let's say you're a defendant, and let's say you have some adequate representation, but many, of course, don't even have that. You're faced with a dilemma. You might have a defense. You might have an explanation for a situation. You might have been involved, but maybe you didn't commit it. Maybe you were loosely involved. Maybe you were put up to it by someone. Maybe your partner is the one who really did it. But you are faced with a situation where you're threatened with the maximum if you choose to go to trial. So they might say, we're going to go after you, and you'll get 25 years if you're convicted at trial. But if you take this plea, and you plead guilty here, you'll get 5. Most people will take that plea, and they don't want to roll the dice because they're going to come after them very, very hard if they go to trial. And that's what where the trial penalty comes in. There's a strong pressure to take the plea because if not, they're going to do everything they can to send a message that turning down a plea is very, very costly.
And you write that plea bargains occur in three different varieties: charge bargaining, sentence bargaining, and fact bargaining.
Right, right. So in terms of there's different standards of evidence in terms of what gets what's required, and sometimes prosecutors actually won't have something that's all that actionable in trial, but they might hide it or not reveal it and say, here's the plea, and the defendant doesn't actually know what they have against them. So there's a lot of smoke and mirrors and curtains that are involved in the plea bargaining process that I think goes against the values of transparency and fairness.
A listener called in to ask, how much variation is there in different states in terms of the treatment of prisoners? Are more conservative states more likely to be more punitive?
That's a really good question, and the answer is yes, absolutely. There is variation across the states, and I make this point in the book that while I'm talking about the U.S. in general, not all states apply in the same way. So, for example, some states like Maine and Vermont or Minnesota are going to be much more lenient, much more, you know, Scandinavian-like, so to speak, on the U.S. spectrum, and other states, which tend to be southern states, but not only. So, in fact, California was a state that up until recently was extremely punitive. It's where the three strikes laws that have been so damaging for so many people originated. But for the most part, the southern states tend to be very, very harsh. But then there are exceptions. And what we've seen over the last few years is some states that are going in the opposite direction, that are moving to reduce mass incarceration. They do it sometimes for different reasons, and New York and New Jersey, Connecticut, Michigan, but also surprisingly Texas, and recently Louisiana, which is one of the worst states, has actually been moving in the opposite direction. So it's not simply, it's certainly not a red state, blue state divide. There is certainly a strong connection to southern states being more punitive, and I think that obviously has to do with the legacy of slavery and the aftermath of the Confederacy and Jim Crow laws and so on, but it's not quite that simple. So there's very. But one point I want to make is that compared to other countries, even the so-called lenient states within the U.S. are much, much harsher with rates of incarceration, with conditions in prisons, which is something we haven't talked about.
Well, can you talk about the Scandinavian model, for example?
Right. Sure. I mean, the Scandinavian model and Germany, which is one of the countries I look at closely, comes close to that. France and the UK, not quite as much. They have some more problems, but they're still very different from the U.S. But the Scandinavian model and the German model are ones where the entire point for prison is to separate somebody from society while they are dangerous to society. And to make that person better and help prepare that person to return to society successfully and productively. So it's really a very different goal. So they have a much higher staff to incarcerated person. I try to avoid the term inmate, which is very loaded, ratio. They have many more psychologists, many more social workers. They work with people engaging their progress and helping them to improve, whether it's overcoming addiction or dealing with trauma in their own past, but help them to return to society. The maximum sentence in many of these countries is about 20 to 22 years.
Even in a murder case?
Yes, even in a murder case. Now, that doesn't mean they automatically get out. It means they get individually evaluated in terms of their progress, whether they're safe and whether they're ready to return. But that's a drastic difference to the United States, where we have hundreds of thousands of people with life without parole sentences and hundreds of thousands more with life with parole sentences, but rarely actually get parole.
What about recidivism? Even here, don't people return to a life of crime in many cases?
Well, yes, they do. And I think there's some reasons for that that have to do with the conditions within prison, which is that we're not making people better. And particularly people who went in with addiction-related crimes, they don't get any better in prison. I mean, in fact, in many prisons, there are drugs that are available, which typically come through corrupt guards who are paid off and who bring in drugs. And there's a whole drug market within prisons. But there's really... people are certainly not getting the treatment that they need, and so when they get out, they have very little opportunity to get a productive job. There's a strong stigma and outright discrimination against people who have a past criminal record. Even though they've served their time and they supposedly paid their debt to society, it's very, very hard to rebuild. And when you combine that, the poverty and the rejection from society and the addiction problem, oftentimes they do go back into a life of crime. So recidivism is quite high in the United States. But it's something that I think doesn't have to be. I think there's so many things that we could do to help bring that down, to recognize the humanity in people who have made mistakes, who to reward those who improve and who work on themselves and who acquire an education. Education in prison is so powerful in terms of its negative effect on recidivism. It brings recidivism virtually close to zero. There have been phenomenal programs in New York State, Bard College and Hudson-on-Link and Cornell University. And there are a number of universities that are getting involved, and I'm trying to create something for Georgetown as well along these lines that helps to give people an education that they typically didn't have a chance to get before they went into prison, and that helps set them onto a different path so that when they come out, they're successful as opposed to becoming part of the cycle that goes right back in.
Before this most recent election, didn't sentencing reform, mainly consisting of reduced penalties for drug-related crimes, enjoy bipartisan support in both the federal and state levels? Also, bipartisan support for early release of people convicted of violent crimes if they've demonstrated progress during their imprisonment? Has all of that been put on hold?
Yes. So the short answer is yes, there was that bipartisan consensus, but it still exists on the state level, although I think everybody's very cautious right now and looking to see what the signals are of the new administration. Remember that 90% of people in prison today are in state prisons, not federal prisons. So the federal government has an effect on the 10% who are in federal prisons, and also obviously sort of an agenda-setting tone in terms of the states, but they're still really state policies that are decisive, and there has been a strong consensus, and I think there really is just about everywhere in the country outside of the little world of Jeff Sessions, who unfortunately on this particular issue has a tremendous amount of power, but that that nonviolent drug offenders do not pose a threat, and that the sentences that they received, often in terms of multiple decades, are just outrageous and indefensible. And so that consensus, I think, still remains. But what I'm trying to do, well, not in any way negating that, and I think all of I support that, but I think that some of the people pushing that made a little bit of a compromise that I find objectionable, which is to say they drew a very strong line between nonviolent drug offender and violent offender. And what I'm trying to do and what I did in the op-ed in the New York Times was try to push a little back on this distinction and to say that even so-called violent offenders need to be able to have a chance to earn their parole. Because I think that the term violent offender really masks a lot of different things. Typically, people will rush to think the worst. They'll think an axe murderer. They'll think, you know, a serial rapist. And they'll say, what, are you crazy? You want to let this person out on the street? Of course not. I'm not talking about, you know, psychopaths. And those are actually quite rare. But what's very common is, you know, the person who's got 20 years for attempted armed robbery, someone who was the getaway driver, someone who took part in a crime but didn't know the partner had a gun, but the presence of a gun turned it into a violent crime, someone who got into a drunken fist fight at a bar, or a drug addict who went through a horrible phase and stole and, you know, perhaps had a knife or something and stole to support that habit. These are all violent criminals, according to the very broad definition we have of violence, and I think we need to rethink that. I think that people who committed even a genuinely violent act at some point are not necessarily inherently permanently violent. They're not always defined by that one act of violence.
Mark, we have very little.
A lot of strong research.
We have very little.
About people aging out.
We have very little time left, and I just want to address the whole debate over the use of solitary confinement in our prisons, and also the fact that there are very high rates of mental illness in U.S. prisons, and people with mental illnesses are often dumped in our jails.
That's right. Yeah, estimates are about 20% of people who are incarcerated in the U.S. have some form of mental illness. Some of that might be mild and treatable, and others are much more severe.
Are they being treated?
Can be a danger to themselves. No, they're not being treated at all. I think it's actually outrageous that they're just locked up, and it really makes their conditions worse. And solitary confinement, which is very common, shockingly common as a form of quote-unquote punishment within prisons in the United States, and this is something that's totally out of line with the European countries, where it's really very rare, it's very punctuated, it's very short, and it's all with the purpose of getting the person back out into general population as soon as possible. But in this country, we have at any given moment over 100,000 people who are in solitary confinement. It's extremely psychologically damaging. The conditions will turn even somebody who doesn't have mental health problems, it will give them to them. I mean, we are making people worse in this country in terms of how we treat them in prisons, not better.
Mark Howard's
book.
I think
we need to drastically rethink that.
Mark Howard's book, Unusually Cruel, Prisons, Punishment, and the Real American Exceptionalism, is published by Oxford University Press. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you for having me.